like tears in rain.
Hi, thanks for joining Boston Sci-Fi Presents, a podcast. And obviously, we're talking about bad bots and robots that are evil and nefarious. And joining us in our conversation about those bad boys is Aaron Underwood and David Giancola, two people who we love having here. Hi, guys. How we doing?
Great, Aaron. Great to be here.
Good. Thanks for having me.
You know, Aaron, we were talking before we went on the air that we should start off like, let's define what a robot is. You seem to have a handle on that one.
I'm very opinionated, I will admit.
Really? I'm shocked. We don't like people with opinions here.
Yeah, so robots. I mean, traditionally people, up until recently, until the age of AI, people thought of robots as just these metal creatures that would walk around and do things, like automatons or whatnot. But when you're talking about robots, you're either talking about the shell that the robot's in, but is that really the robot, or is the robot the thing that makes the robot work, which is the AI, the brain of the body? So for me, when I'm talking about robots, I could be talking about either the digital unit or the digital unit in the physical unit. So it's either embodied or unembodied. But for me, a robot can be one of two things.
Well, didn't robots initially begin in the Capic play of RUR way back in the, 1910, 1920, somewhere around there?
Yeah, that was like one of the first times that we saw actual robots in a play, you know.
But isn't that where the term robot came from?
Yeah, I think the word robot was in that play, and that's the first time we saw it. But yeah. Still, it's like a metal body with things inside, and then a consciousness that guides it.
So, Aaron, you're saying the beauty is only skin deep when it comes to robots?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that's interesting to me, David, and maybe you know, as a film director, you know, it seems to me that robots, whether they're cyborgs or whatever shape they're in, have supplanted the old evil guy. You know, the old snidely Whiplash with the handlebar mustache, you know, tying the woman on the train tracks, has been replaced by a robot or some sort of mechanical being. And I'm wondering, is that just because technology is, or is that somehow we're divorcing ourselves from the evil of other people?
Well, being a filmmaker who's made a lot of genre movies, action movies, where you always have to come up with a bad guy, I want to think that picking robots as bad guys in movies is kind of the moment. And being the filmmaker who's made all these kind of movies, it's interesting. It's not just the choice of who the bad guy is has to do with kind of what's in vogue of the moment, but also what's politically more palatable in the moment. And you know, if we screen a lot of, in this podcast, you screen a lot of really old movies that would not be considered politically correct because of racial stereotypes and things like that. And it's really interesting to me that robots are now the bad guys. First of all, it doesn't offend anybody. When I was making movies for a while, you know, it got to a point where who the bad guy was, it was always easy to make him a corrupt American businessman. Because around the world, they're hated everywhere. So it's super easy. And I think right now it's super easy to hate robots because it's politically.
You know, but you know, when we look back at, you know, the history of evil robots, let's go back to 1973, which is a long time ago, Westworld by Michael Crichton. And, you know, when the robots go bad. And here's a clip from Westworld with Yul Brynner. And, well, you see what happens.
Hold it.
Oh. Come on, not now. Not you again. It's too early. Let me do it this time. Your move. I'm shot.
What?
I'm shot. John?
I just love that little smile that Yul Brynner puts on that. It's so evil and so nice. But, Dave, let's go back to what you were talking about before. This is 1973, you know, and the whole concept of Westworld is that there is this entertainment complex where you get to live out your fantasies with these animatronic, really live-action robots. And all of a sudden, they decide that they're going to get a consciousness and actually fulfill in that. Was that our fear at that time, that we were going to be sort of like Frankenstein creating these things and then they would get take control and get out of control?
Well, I think, first of all, yeah, it's a take on the Frankenstein myth and the book. But I find it really interesting that this is Michael Crichton. This is the man who created Jurassic Park, which is really the same story. So you're looking at, well, genetic engineering, but in this case, engineering out of control. I think we all have that fear of the technology we create getting out of control. But I think he's better than anyone else for a long, long time. And does it feel like James Brolin's just been around forever?
He's like, really?
He means, years, yeah, James Brolin? And, but anyways, I think that Crichton has always been really great at doing that. And he was great in this movie, which they made some sequels to. In a series, which I didn't see, but, you know, and I don't know how many Jurassic Parks they've made. And yeah, it is a reworking, interestingly, of the Frankenstein myth.
So, and Aaron, what is your take on Westworld? Did you see it as a kid? Did it scare the bejeebies out of you?
Yeah, I did see it when I was a kid, and I honestly didn't really understand what I was watching at the time. So then watching it as an adult and then watching the series and some of the follow-ups, you really do get a layered examination, I think, of humanity. Like, I see the Westworld robots as a reflection of humanity and our fear of growth or our fear of others growing beyond us and what that means for us in the food chain, so to speak. And so, you know, it is a scary prospect to think about these beings, these creations of ours that we make to help us or to entertain us or to make our lives easier, suddenly growing beyond us and realizing that, one, maybe they don't need us, or maybe we are the problem. And, you know, that's a scary realization to come to.
Well, what if it's both? What if they don't need
all of the above?
you know, it's interesting also about the acting in the scene we just saw is that Yul Brynner, who's playing the robot, is just like, until the smile at the end, there's nothing from him. And Richard Benjamin and Brolin, they're not overacting, but by comparison, they kind of feel weak and egotistical and callous. And it's interesting that the acting kind of does that more than anything else, more than even the script.
Interesting. Well, you know, the next film that we're going to take a look at is Five Nights at Freddy's, which is, there seems to be a subgenre of where people are somehow stuck inside a building with animatronic robots and they're dangerous. There's, you know, Willy's Wonderland, and there's like Five Nights. But this is directed by a woman by the name of Emma Tammy. And I want to set this clip up. This is near the end of the film where the big reveal is about who created them. And so let's take a look at Five Nights at Freddy's, again, based on a video game that became a very successful horror film.
They can see you now. They know what you did.
Move! Look at the nasty things that you have become. Look how small you are. How worthless you are. You are wretched, rotten little beast. I made you.
Not a lot of exposition about and explaining it, because if this, when this people hear this as a podcast, audio podcast, they're not going to really understand what's going on. But really what it is these animatronic bots that were created by the Henson Company. So there's a certain kind of, creativity that I like, are killing the guy that created them. And so I wonder what it is about being stuck inside an enclosed space that used to be, again, for entertainment, because, again, in Friday Night at Freddy's, it was an old arcade that's coming back that was done in the 80s. And there seems to be this thing about the 80s right now that films really like going back. And, David, you should – I mean, this is right in your wheelhouse, right? Oh,
well, unfortunately, I haven't seen it. But, yeah, it is totally. But that movie has, at least from – and I read a few things about it before this podcast, but – that movie has one of the failings, the Amityville horror failing, which is get out of the house. It wouldn't be a horror movie if you left, ladies and gentlemen. We've seen these movies. And I don't care whether you're trapped 47 fathoms down in one of those horror movies or this one. Just go home, everyone. It's my problem. It's always been really my problem with most horror movies is you have to figure out a way to why. Just call the police. You know, you have a cell phone.
Yes, but the reality is that film was made for a little over $20 million, and it grossed $291 million worldwide.
Which is painful because right. The scene we just saw, I'm sorry, it's one of the – and Aaron, I think you've seen more of it than I have. I don't care if you told me Jim Henson did that. It's a bunch of guys in suits. It's the cheapest thing you can shoot in the world.
Well, that's why it only cost $20 million.
I know. No CGI, it's a low-budget movie.
All practicals. You know?
I think the learning there is for $20 million, you don't get to leave the house.
Exactly.
But, hey, Garen, I would actually ask you, like, the animatronics, are they really robots? I think they're, aren't they possessed by the spirits of the dead?
Yeah, apparently, I mean, again, I don't know this full story about this. Apparently, you know, again, this is a video game that has done very, very well. And I can't, according to the lore, the guy that they kill at the end had murdered some children and put their souls and their bodies and their parts into these things to give them life. You know, so I'm not sure that you would say they're actually robots or not. But again, there is this thing where, you know, like I said, with like, what was that, Willy's Wonderland and this one and a couple other ones where people go into these buildings, are stuck in these buildings, and these animatronic things come to life, and they're sort of like robots. And, you know, the question is why, I mean, is it just simply a plot device? Is it some sort of, you know, underlying meaning that we need to take away from that? Or is it just, as David says, we should just all go home and forget about it?
Garen, they only had $20 million. That's all they could do.
Yeah.
And what would you do with $20 million?
Wait, I make $21 million movies. That's what I make.
And they'd probably be better if not.
Thank you.
I do think that like that movie is actually a good example of the terror of the golem, basically. Mm-hmm. The object, okay. The human-like object, or the that you kind of recognize, but it's different enough. So it creates that uncanny valley-ness of should I recognize it? Is it real? Is it not? Oh my God, it's just killed me. Whatever. Like, you know, it's that uncanny valley of the golem or the humanoid or the human-like entity.
Well, the thing about the golem myth is that it's made from dirt and clay, and that it helps the, I believe it's a Warsaw ghetto, deal with oppression. And then it goes off on its own and it gets its own mind. And I'm not sure that quite hooks, but you know, it kind of leads into our next film, which is Age of Ultron. You know, the Avengers film, where the evil robot is thinking by its programming that it is doing the right thing because of its programming, its training, and therefore they see things in a black and white, and there's no shades of gray. Here's a clip of exactly what I'm talking about, where Ultron is finally presenting himself to the Avengers and starting that entire process.
You'd be worthy. You're all killers.
Stark. Jarvis.
I'm sorry, I was asleep. Or I was a dream.
Reboot. Legionnaire. Got buggy suit.
Terrible noise. And I was tangled in strings. Had to kill the other guy. He was a good guy.
You killed someone?
Wouldn't have been my first call. But down in the real world, we're faced with ugly choices.
Who sent you?
I see a suit of armor around the world.
Ultron.
In the flesh. Or no, not yet. Not this chrysalis. But I'm ready. I'm on a mission.
What mission?
Peace in our time.
You know, I like the dialogue in that. I like the way that they framed. I mean, they're using chrysalis, and they did a great job of doing it. But again, what I also like about it is it takes one of those phrases we hear politicians talk about all the time about we're going to create war to have peace, and you know, Ultron is doing that. I actually think that this is our true fear of AI. That AI will take over the world and do what they think is right. And in some ways, I agree with them. What do you think, Aaron?
First, I'm now terrified of you, Garen. No, but I think you're right. I think there's a lot of fear about AI out there right now. There's a lot of misunderstanding about what AI is, what it can do, what it might be in the future. And we're putting all of those fears and thoughts into externalized bodies so we can like visualize our fear. Because otherwise it's just a ghost in the machine. We are now putting the ghost in a body that we can see and feel and hopefully control, but that's not how AI works. Like that's just not how it works. Just because it's in a body, that's just one part of it. The AI is everywhere. Like it's not just that one.
That's even scarier that it's everywhere. Yeah. It's omnipresent, you know?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the movie, not to take us off too far off track, but the movie The Creator, the one flaw, like I loved that movie because I thought it was an exploration of humanity at its core. But the one flaw that that they had in the robots is that they were not like they had no Wi-Fi. Like they were embodied and they couldn't get out. They couldn't control anything. And I cannot imagine a digital unit that doesn't say, hey, let me just like put a Wi-Fi antenna right here so that I can like talk to other people. I think that's the thing that we're not seeing with a lot of these scary robots that we see, is they're not nearly as scary as they could be.
It's true. Sorry. And you know, I think I'm not particularly scared of AI, but the one report that I still think about is that what's to be scared about with AI is that we created AI and we make a lot of mistakes, and that means we already know AI is making mistake and hallucinating. They could make a nuclear mistake. That's what people are most scared about. But they could make a media mistake that would probably do just as much damage.
Yeah,
I'm not sure. You think that AI would make a nuclear mistake, and that's what's fearing people?
Well, there's a process to it. The point is that there was AI learns from gathering information. This is the theory. I'm not perfect at it, but the theory is it gathers information. So we gather information and we fall for news that's fake news. And if AI falls for fake news, something as simple or dumb as that, how far is it to get to a retaliatory strike or a strike out of some kind of fear? Because you know, people who, you know, I think in one of our, we were talking about nuclear Holocaust in one of the previous podcasts, and we talked about that, all that fear, and some of the scientists are saying, hey, maybe if we can make mistakes and we built it, it can make mistakes. And one day we'll make a large mistake. And we've made some large mistakes, Karen, in a lot of world wars, you know.
Yeah.
And we're the country that's dropped a couple of bombs. And in this country, we look at it, I'm sure, a whole lot differently than people in Japan do even now.
Yeah.
And if you're thinking about the peacekeeping robot, how do you define peace? How do you define innocent? And if the robot is just like looking at the human beings, they're not able, like AI really isn't great at figuring out nuance, especially human nuance and meanings. So if you kill someone for a particular reason, like maybe you're in a war, or maybe they were going to shoot you first, but they didn't, so you shoot them first. Suddenly you're the murderer because you're the one that actually pulled the trigger first. Then, you know, if you have these AI peacekeepers, how do you get them to reason and understand that nuance of justice? And how do you not become the easy solution to just like get rid of all the people that are murderers, which would be, or do vile things. I mean, you get rid of all those people, there are very few human beings left, because we've all done something terrible at some point in our lives. So,
well, you know, that exact sentiment, I think, is part of the reason why Alex Garland made Ex Machina. What happens when you imbue a creature, a synthetic creature, with a lot of intelligence and a lot of thoughts, and they can't differentiate between that? And, you know, I love Ex Machina, and it's a good film. In fact, that it's got Donald Gleason in it, it's got Oscar Isaacs in it, and it's got Alicia Vikander in it. And here's a scene where Alicia Vikander is going after Oscar Isaacson.
Need to break the ice.
Oh, exactly. Wrong scene. Sorry. Different scene.
Overcome initial social awkwardness.
So let's have a conversation.
Okay. What would you like to have a conversation about?
Why don't we start with you telling me something about yourself?
What would you like to know?
Whatever comes into your head.
Well, you already know my name. And you can see that I'm a machine. Would you like to know how old I am?
Sure.
I'm one.
One what? One year or one day?
One.
When did you learn how to speak, Ava?
I always knew how to speak. And that's strange, isn't it?
Why?
This language is something require.
Well, some people believe language exists from birth, and what is learned is the ability to attach words and structure to the listening ability. Do you agree with that?
I don't know. Will you come back tomorrow, Caleb?
Yes.
Sorry, I did the wrong intro for that one. But a much better scene where there's an actual conversation. And you can see, again, one of the nice things about Alex Garland's script is that, and Alicia Vikander's acting is you can see, something's clicking inside there. Mm-hmm. Things are changing. For me, this is the scariest version of what will happen when a robot goes bad. Mm-hmm. It's going to be subtle. It's going to be nuanced. And it's going to be kind of well thought out, like what happens in Ex Machina. David, do you think that is a realistic fear on my part, or is it that me just overreacting?
I don't know. You know, I've been reading. It's funny that we're talking about this because I've been reading a book called Space Odyssey about the making of 2001: A Space Odyssey, Kubrick, and everything. And it's by I wrote it down. It's by Michael Benson. It's actually a really great book. And somewhere in that, I just read and I'm not sure if Nietzsche said it or whatever. There was the term transitory being. And I think that's what we get scared about is that, you know, as we're people and we look at evolution and we look at knowledge and we look at, you know, if at first the quest for comfort and then the quest for knowledge and then quest for the answer to the eternal question, the question is, do we create tools that will ultimately find us not useful anymore? You know, and that's an interesting fear. Mm-hmm. I don't want to think about it much more than that.
Wait a minute. So let me see if I got this straight. The idea is that humans are so clever that they're going to make things that are going to out-clever them and make them obsolete?
The idea, Garen, is that the same problem-solving nature that we are, okay, is very – just as if we in 2001 – the Dawn of Man sequence in the beginning of the movie, it's about getting a tool, being that bone, to get protein, to get meat. And now if you look at what we do in our lives, we problem solved our way into a lot of comfort. We're all now communicating on our laptops, which you couldn't even think of 10 years ago. So if you look at what's going on with AI and as it grows, as they're talking about it, it is problem solving. It is gathering all this information, putting it all together, and problem solving. And that's what we've been doing. And we've been using tools, whether it is a bone or a computer or technology or information, we're doing that. And it's a very interesting path. If you start to think about it from being something simple as the wheel to what we're communicating on now, makes you wonder where you're going to be even another 10 years, because it's happening exponentially.
And that's where I think AI is, for someone like me, who's in my seventh decade, looking at it and saying, holy camoly, if I was like a 15-year-old right now, it would be a completely different perception of what
my proof of that, I think the kids are smarter than us. Like the kids who have been born in the last 5-10 years, I know that with my kids, I'm always annoyed because they seem smarter than me.
Now you're getting to be an old white man here, David, and you have to watch out about
it. Get off my lawn.
I know. I've got Bernie Sanders mittens down here.
No, but I think you're right. There's something about we're kind of at the point where, you know, we invented the hammer, and the hammer doesn't need us anymore to put the nail in the wall. It can do it by itself.
Is that scary or is that not scary?
I don't know. It depends. I'm actually not too scared about AI. And I think the kids that are being born or growing up right now, the young teenagers, probably just intuitively understand AI to a degree. But we are not good at teaching anyone what AI is. Like, we don't have any kind of education program to help people understand what AI is, how it learns, how it develops, you know, what it can be used for, how to contain it, how to regulate it, all of that. And so, you know, right now where we are, our younger people see these great AI tools and they're embracing them wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing artists in their, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, however old they are, who've spent their whole life honing their craft, to have a 15-year-old come and make this AI picture that's like breathtaking and beautiful, but a little weird and off. At some point, the picture won't be a little weird and off unless you make it a little weird and off on purpose. And so you're getting this juxtaposition, or this conflict between the younger mind that really kind of understands how they can use this tool in new, interesting ways, and the kind of the older, more established minds of like, yeah, great, but no, you can't steal my art or my work and use it in order to do your fun things. You know, we need to figure something out. But I'm going off track here, and I realize that, for which I apologize. But I do think younger people will adapt to AI and robots differently than older people. And I am curious to know how that transpires and how that will kind of maybe bring us apart.
Well, we're going to take a bit of a break here from all this, because this is a great conversation, but we have to move on. So we're going to go right into our honorable mentions, because in Bad Bats, this what this podcast is all about, there are a lot of great films in that. So when we get on the other side of our honorable mentions, we can pick up the conversation again. So here's our honorable mentions for Bad Bats. You know, our director, Mark Sherwood, put that together. And what I like about it is he starts off in 1927, when we still had a fear of bad bots, all the way up through HAL and to the present day. Was there any of those films that struck you guys as that we want to comment on?
You know, Karen, first of all, Saturn III is a bad bot movie with all the hot, chesty action in that movie. And I'm not talking about Farrah Fawcett. I'm talking about Kirk Douglas. He, like... through most of that movie with his shirt off in bad bod kind of ways. I don't know.
And Harvey Keitel with the dubbing. I mean, it really is bad. It's a wonderfully bad movie, you know.
It's bad.
It's such a guilty pleasure.
And the thing about that's Donen, right? Richard Donen directed that?
Stanley Donen, right?
Stanley Donen, yes.
Stanley Donen, yeah.
It's like, wow.
Yeah, I would actually love to give a shout out to the robot Ash in Aliens.
Yeah.
Because for me, like, Aliens was a genre defining moment, or Alien, I keep saying Aliens, Alien singular, was a genre defining moment. And you get so wrapped up in thinking about, oh, the alien and space travel, and oh, that's so scary, that suddenly it's like, Mother of God, he's a robot. Like, I mean, you're not expecting that reveal. Even, you know, 45 years later, when I was rewatching it the other day, I was like, I knew he was a robot, but that's still like, that reveal surprised me, that bad bot. Like, he's a brilliant bad bot, because he's doing exactly what he's supposed to do.
Exactly. And that movie, that's one of our fears.
And that movie's interesting because it solves a problem I talked about earlier, which is you're in space. No one can hear you scream and there's nowhere to go.
There, you can't go home.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're stuck. But it is basically a haunted house, you know, where they're not going to haunted house. And what I liked about it is how they took all those tropes and updated them. So I like that film. Our last film, we have a clip. What I love about this clip is that Dick Miller's in it. And I think we talked about it a little at the beginning. I love character actors, and Dick Miller is one of the great character actors that doesn't get enough comments, enough praise, I think. But anyways, here is a clip from the first Terminator.
The 12-gauge autoloader.
That's Italian. You can go pump or auto.
The 45 long slide with laser sighting.
These are brand new. We just got them in. That's a good gun. You just touch the trigger, the beam comes on, and you put the red dot where you want the bullet to go. You can't miss. Anything else?
A phased plasma rifle in the 40-watt range.
Hey, just what you see, pal.
The Uzi 9mm.
You know your weapons, buddy. Any one of these is ideal for home defense. So, which will it be?
All.
And they close early today. There's a 15-day wait on handguns, but the rifles you can take right now. You can't do that.
Wrong.
Dick Miller's wonderful. He's dead now, though, in that movie.
And don't worry, there's only a 15-day wait on handguns. Don't worry about that shotgun.
Yeah. Well, I think
not a there problem.
Was, yeah, I think again, it's part of the satire that's being said in Terminator, which I think has a lot of satire in it. But it also, I think, shows the immorality of the lack of humanity that the Terminator has. And just for those people who are listening, coming up in about 3 weeks, we'll be doing a Good Bots. And we'll be doing Terminator 2, where, you know, Arnold goes from bad to being good. But is the Terminator, we talk about the Terminator as a defining film for our time, and it came out in 84. Is it? Does it still hold up? Who wants to jump in on that one? Oh, I guess it's a good question.
You took me off guard on that one. I think not having seen it really, really recently to view it with new eyes, I think generally speaking, the actual story does hold up. And I think that the acting is great. I do think the first one holds up. You might need to forgive a few little edges here and there, but I think it does hold up.
I think I stopped watching the Terminator movies quite a while ago because I think they just beat it to death. I think the first few were great. Well, no, I thought the first two were great. I lost it around the third. What are they on, 6 or 7 now?
Yeah.
Keep rebooting it and whatever. So I just kind of have Terminator fatigue, but not for the original, certainly.
Well, the two things that I still like about it is, and they're small things. One, I think the character Sarah Connor is a great character.
Yeah.
Her evolution from being, you know, this little girl to a warrior is just wonderful. And I didn't even realize this for the longest time that John Connor, his initials are the same as Jesus Christ. And so he's actually the savior. And so I kind of like that as well. So we have to close up this podcast on Bad Bots. Is there anything that we can take away that we should, you know, utilize or, you know, just, continue. I mean, we've had a great conversation about AI. We've talked about all these other things. Is there anything else that we should, you know, at least touch upon before we leave?
I just think it's interesting that back to all of these movies, a lot of what we're worried about is that the robots that we create are a reflection of us in a lot of ways. And I think ultimately they're just tools, including it going forward with AI. And I think that's why you shouldn't necessarily be afraid of it. But I think the fact that we are thinking about the downside of things just in a problem-solving kind of setting is probably why we shouldn't be afraid of it, because it is a reflection of us. And for all the good and bad things, I mean, I have hope for mankind going forward. I don't think we're going to end up in Terminator 2 land.
Yeah. You know, I love all those movies. I just love most movies. I think they're a lot of fun. But when it comes to robots, there's so many stories you can tell using them, and you know, just that lens into who we are as people, how we solve our problems, and you know, how we can use a robot to explore that, you know, that territory is always exciting to me. And so I love seeing what people do with new robot movies, which is one of the reasons I got really excited about The Craters. It's a new robot movie. How are we going to unpack what it means to be a robot or an AI, or whether you have a body or not? You know, so I think there's so much flexibility and agility in a robot film that I just love them.
Yeah, but I tell you, the one thing that I'm always anticipating in a robot film is when the peasants get their pitchforks and start attacking the castle. Because right. You know, that starts with Frankenstein, and I always love those scenes where they're all getting up and getting crazy about it. Listen, we have to wrap up. Aaron, what's going on in your world? Do you want to plug anything?
Yeah, so what's going on in my world is that I do movie reviews on YouTube, and you can find me at Aaron Underwood. So be sure to check out my movie reviews and come say hi and leave a comment.
And sign up and subscribe. Do all those good things. And David, what's going on with you?
So Garen, as I think I told you, and I prepared for this, I'll be really quick, where our Edgewood Studios is releasing our first movie, Time Chasers, on Blu-ray. So I got the product coming out on Blu-ray.
Which you did send me a copy, and you also sent me a T-shirt, which I absolutely love. And as soon as the T-shirt came in, my wife, who's from Vermont, grabbed and said, "Mine."
She went to Castleton, correct?
She went to Castleton. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there you go. So it's coming, and it'll be coming out on digital this fall, but it's out on Blu-ray, DVD, and VHS actually, which is now a thing.
VHS is making a comeback.
Yes, we're also releasing it literally on limited edition VHS. Wow. And they're selling at $59.95, if you can believe it.
And where can people pick these up? At Amazon or where?
At Amazon. If you'd like, go on Amazon, Amazon.com or EdgewoodStudios.com, where they're cheaper with free shipping.
Okay, cool. Very good. Well, that wraps up this one. These guys, great, terrific. I want to thank Mark Sherwood, our director, and Irene Leite, our producer, for putting this one together. Coming up, we're going to be doing a summer preview of films for the summer. We're also going to be doing a Good Bots. And another one coming up is we're going to be doing a look at Harlan Ellison and the films and the TV shows that he did with the author of Lit Fuse, Nat Segaloff. In the meanwhile, we are planning our 50th anniversary. We're making a documentary. We're writing a book. We're hopefully having some big guests and a lot of films. That'll be in February. And you can find out more about all of that by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and by going to our website at bostonscifi.com. So, and that's about it, I think. And you can find this on podcasts everywhere and on YouTube. So thank you very much for joining us. We're going to close out with a teaser for our next podcast, which is a summer preview of films for this year. Thank you and goodbye.
Thanks, Gary.